In graduate school, I took, and then dropped, a course in which the words I think were forbidden. Anything said, particularly if it had to do with moral judgments, had to be a matter of I feel. Such courses and the thinking they encourage, according to C.S. Lewis, leave destruction in their wake. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast, The After Dinner Scholar. In his book, The Abolition of Man, Lewis argued that the practical result of making all moral judgments subjective, I feel rather than I think, quote, must be the destruction of the society which accepts it, close quote. Lewis saw in 1943, and we, 75 years later, certainly see, the ravages of such subjectivity. And that's one of the reasons we've chosen Lewis's Abolition of Man as our Wyoming Catholic College Book of the Year. But there's a catch, wrote Lewis. Radical subjectivity, while easy to preach, is for the most part impossible. When people claim to reject the objective, what Lewis calls the Tao, natural law, or traditional morality, they are nonetheless forced to operate by smuggling shreds of the Tao back into their thinking. To help us understand the second lecture of The Abolition of Man, a lecture Lewis entitled simply The Way, we're joined by author and scholar Joseph Pierce. Mr. Pierce is director of book publishing at the Augustine Institute. He's editor of both the St. Austin Review and Faith and Culture, and series editor of the Ignatius Critical Editions. In addition, he's a member of Wyoming Catholic College's Catholic Scholars Advisory Board. After arguing in his first lecture that Gaius and Titius injected an unhealthy skepticism and subjectivism into moral discourse, Lewis wrote, in fact, Gaius and Titius will be found to hold with complete uncritical dogmatism the whole system of values which happen to be in vogue among moderately educated young men of the professional class during the period between the two wars. The skepticism is on the surface. It's about other people's values, he says. They're not nearly skeptical enough of their own position. How is it that subjectivity ends up creating dogmatists?
Well, one of the great ironies, of course, is that subjectivism, which is the manifestation of relativism, maintains on the one hand that the good, the true, and the beautiful do not exist except as, should we say, prefaces, prejudices, and opinions. And therefore, there's no objective, verifiable goodness, truth, or beauty. And yet, in order to hold that position, they take a dogmatic, absolutist position that there can only be one view of goodness, truth, and beauty, and that is there's no such thing as goodness, truth, and beauty. So there's an irony that the relativist, in preaching relativism, is practicing dogmatism.
Is that what Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI meant when he talked about the dictatorship of relativism?
It's exactly what he meant by that phrase, the dictatorship of relativism, because we're living under a tyranny now of relativism. And you only have to look at the absence of discourse on any issues that question the fundamental tenets of relativism to know that we live in a very dogmatic and ideologically tyrannical culture at the moment. These people are dogmatic and puritanical because of their dogmatism.
Now, Lewis brought up the question of self-sacrifice, that is, dying to preserve society, dying as a soldier or something like that. And he says that given Gaius and Titius's framework, he asked, why ought we to die for our country? Why ought we to die for anything? How does he go about proving that within their framework, no one ought really to do anything?
Right, because the actual existence of an ought presupposes that there is something to which we are guided or attracted or something within ourselves which belongs or is part of something beyond ourselves. And again, this is the axiomatic question that divides all of us as individuals and also human society throughout history, is the extent to which we are objective. In other words, that we lay down our lives, and therefore the quotation here about the soldier laying down his lives can be seen as a metaphor for something much broader. That in order to actually perceive reality, we have to get outside and beyond ourselves. In order to get outside and beyond ourselves, we have to subject ourselves to an objective reality which is larger than us. And that requires not just the courage of the soldier who's willing to lay down his life physically, but in order to engage with the good, in other words, with the holy, we have to sacrifice ourselves in love for the beloved, even if the beloved is our enemy. And the same thing would apply for truth. If we want to actually perceive the truth, we have to lay our prejudices aside and engage with that which is beyond ourselves, that which is outside ourselves. And the same thing with beauty. Beauty is not in the eye of the beholder, it's in the thing beheld. And unless we get out of the way, we can't behold it. So in other words, on all levels of perception of reality, it's absolutely imperative that we become selfless creatures, that we lay down our lives for something which is bigger than ourselves. So that really is what Lewis is getting at in part two, or the second lecture of The Abolition of Man.
Well, and he explains how our consciences are constantly telling us that we ought, and Lewis attributes that to what he calls the Tao, using that word from Lao Tzu, from Chinese philosophy. What does he mean by the Tao, and why does he even choose that word?
Well, I think that the first reason would be that he wants to use his and Tolkien's own terminology about these things. He wants to get past those watchful dragons. That if we talk about the natural law in terms of overt terms of Christian philosophy, then the relativists, being the dogmatists they are, would simply refuse to listen. You know, they don't think that anything that Christianity has to say is something they need to take into account, and they're unwilling to engage with 2,000 years of Christian philosophy. So if you sidestep that strategically or pragmatically by talking about the natural law in terms of Eastern religion, right, in terms of the Tao or the Tao. And that's exactly what he does here, because that really forces the relativist to engage, because you're not putting the red rag to the ball of Christianity into the picture. You're just saying, well, look, this is ancient philosophy, and it transcends all cultures, the East and West, and therefore it's all about the existence of a natural law which guides us towards an understanding of what is truly good, and that's why we feel that we ought to do what's good, because it's actually inherent within who we are as human beings. But using the Tao, as opposed to Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine, allows him to engage with the secular culture in a way that being overtly Christian would not.
Mm-hmm. Yet for all of that, Lewis admits that you can't prove the Tao. Why not? And if we can't prove it, why obey it?
Well, I think, that you can say you can't prove it in terms of empiricism, all right? It's not something which is measurable or definable in terms of materialistic data. But I think that Lewis does agree, and in fact, the very thing he's arguing here, that that not just common sense, but if you like, John Henry Newman would call the grammar of assent, by all of the evidence of human experience and our own personal experience suggests so strongly that the Tao or natural law exists, that really it's a violation of not just common sense, reason to suggest otherwise.
Mm-hmm. And while those he calls the innovators want to reject the possibility of the Tao, at the same time, their rejection of the Tao is only possible, he says, quote, with shreds of the Tao. Help us to understand that apparent paradox.
Yeah, I mean, the point is that human dialogue and human dialectic is impossible without using reality. And so, in other words, that that people that are moral relativists can only argue their case by being objectively moral in the way they argue their position. In other words, they have to take a morally objective stance in order to argue for the non-existence of no such thing as moral objectivity. The whole idea of us desiring the good, that being drawn towards the good, arguing from the good, is something just so inherent to who we are that it's impossible for us to actually argue anything without taking that, if you like, primal position.
Mm-hmm. So we really can't do without this idea of the Tao, even if we pretend we are doing without it.
Exactly. Well, that's the irony, of course, you know, is that the very people that argue against its existence have to argue in terms that are predicated by it in order to do so. I mean, they're clearly blind to the absurdity of their own position because they're having to break their own rules in order to actually argue for them.
In a recent essay about the abolition of man, you wrote, "Every ideology is a partial truth, but a truth exploded to insanity and devoid of context, proportionality, and balance." Would you unpack that a little bit for us in light of the abolition of man?
The roots of that go back beyond, before the abolition of man, to a work that was very influential upon Lewis and actually helped frame, if you like, Lewis's understanding of the cosmos. And that was Chesterton's book, Heretics, and his book, The Everlasting Man, I should say, and his book, Orthodoxy, both of which were very influential upon Lewis. And in that, you know, Chesterton talks about ideology. I don't think he used the term, but that's what he's talking about. He talks about meaning heresies, but it's just a formal theological word for the same thing. What these ideologies do is they take one aspect of the truth, and then they explode that or caricature that out of all objective proportion to the rest of the truth of which it is a part. And in consequence, you have a madness that sees one part of the truth and uses that one part of the truth to eclipse the whole picture. And that's why you see that, you know, various ideologies throughout the history of man, particularly since the Enlightenment, have taken one aspect of the truth and blown it out of proportion and in consequence have created tyrannies. Now, we see it with the French Revolution, we see it with the communists, we see it with the Nazis, and we see it with the culture of death in which we're living now, with the systematic infanticide and extermination of the disabled. Once you take one aspect of the truth and make that the whole truth, you end up with a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. And that's just taking a piece of the Tao and running away with it, but forgetting the rest of the Tao that also applies.
Yeah, not seeing the whole picture, taking one part of which is your particular favorite part and ignoring all the rest and making that one part your personal god, which becomes an idol, and that idolatry leads to insanity.
C.S. Lewis argued that the Tao, or natural law, is an all-or-nothing proposition. If you accept parts of the Tao, you must accept the whole. If you reject parts of the Tao, the entire thing goes out the window. But what if, he posits at the end of the second lecture, what if we say, fine, we reject all precepts of the Tao, saying, very well, we shall probably find that we can get on quite comfortably without them. What then? His response is in the final lecture, the subject of our next podcast. The After Dinner Scholar podcast is a weekly gift from Wyoming Catholic College to you, our friends and supporters, as well as to the larger world. It's offered free of charge, and we intend to keep it that way. It is, however, as you might imagine, not free to produce and distribute. Faculty, support staff, and I work hard to produce the best product we can, and in addition to our time, there are other podcast expenses. If you enjoy listening to our professors, board members, advisors, and guests talk about the books and ideas that they love and that make up our integrated curriculum, please consider a gift now at the end of the year to help offset the costs of producing and distributing the After Dinner Scholar. Visit wyomingcatholiccollege.edu/podcast to make your end-of-the-year gift today. Thank you in advance for your generosity. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.